You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Chris Molina.
And I'm Judith Sears Poisson. Coming up, we hear about a new NCAA commission led by Condoleezza Rice that was formed to help address the scandals the organization has been facing.
First, there are now more than 6,000 craft breweries in the United States, but despite how that looks, Americans' taste in beer really hasn't changed all that much.
The best-selling beers in America are still Bud Light, Coors Light, and Miller Lite. And as our next guest says, craft breweries are adjusting to this reality by brewing more corporate lager-like beers, what he calls blander beers.
So how did so-called bland beers come to dominate American taste? Ranjit Degay joins us now. He's a professor of economics at the State University of New York in Oswego with a specialty in American social and economic history. He recently wrote about this for the website The Conversation. Ranjit, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you.
So I feel like, Ranjit, we're throwing you into the lion's den here a little bit by bringing you onto Wisconsin Public Radio. Folks love their craft beer around here, but despite that, you're saying that bland beer, by and large, still the preferred taste of beer in America. How are you measuring this?
Just by what people are drinking. There's, you know, industry statistics on that. And, yeah, craft beer, as far as what people purchase, as opposed to the dollar value that they spend on it, it's most about 7/8 non-craft beer.
And when you say bland beer, what are the kind of beers that you're talking about?
The light beers in particular. Those are the ones that have the lowest hop content and malt content. Those are the traditional ingredients of beer. All beers have those to some extent. And they have the least of them. So they literally are more watery than other types of beer.
And so we're hearing a lot of craft breweries, they're coming out with like in-your-face IPAs, heavy beers, things like that. That appeals to a certain segment of beer drinkers, I would imagine, but there's still kind of this untapped market, if you will, for people looking for something else. So we are starting to see craft beers maybe dial it back just a little bit to try to capture that mainstream beer drinker.
Yeah, the blonde ales are very popular. I think a lot of the craft beers have a certain snob appeal that's independent of their appeal to taste buds. So some people want something that's not one of the corporate beers, and they go for something that tastes more like one of those. I mean, beer is an acquired taste to begin with.
And so we might think, okay, we've heard about this craft beer explosion. You know, breweries are opening up everywhere. We might be wondering, well, maybe why this isn't more popular. You kind of looked into history to discover how we developed this taste for so-called bland beer to begin with. And you write in your piece that America never really developed a homegrown brewing tradition. Can you talk more about that?
Yeah, I mean, we're a nation of immigrants. The English immigrants brought with them English ales. And a lot of the hoppy, in-your-face beers that you mentioned, like India Pale Ales, those are really from that English ale tradition. But we were never a big drinking nation of English ales. There was a lot of drinking going on in the early 19th century, but it tended to be spirits, rum and then whiskey in particular. And cider was actually more popular, probably because it was easy to make at home, especially if you had apple trees in your yard, than beer was.
And in those,
so then you have the influx of Germans in the mid-19th century, and German lager was a superior product. It was, you know, very tasty beer. The German lager of the mid-19th century was actually more like dark beer, like a dark lager. It would be like a Heineken Dark or a Beck's Dark, that kind of thing. And it also stored very well. It was very stable. If you opened up one of those, it was probably not going to be, you know, spoiled or skunked.
And you also point out that temperance movements in early America also played a role in some of the rise of the biggest brands that we see today, including Pabst Blue Ribbon here in Wisconsin. Now, I kind of would have assumed that by their nature, temperance movements would have kind of had the opposite effect. So what happens?
Well, the key thing is whether beer is a temperance beverage or not. It sounds a bit ridiculous, you know, if you've ever been on a college campus, to think of beer as a temperance beverage. But compared to whiskey and other spirits, a lot of people thought beer was much milder, certainly, you know, by the ounce it is. And there were a lot of people, including President John Adams, Adam Smith, President James Madison, the New York Times, and the brewers themselves, who said beer is a temperance beverage. If you drink it in moderation, it's not intoxicating. Some brewers even went out on a limb and said it's impossible to get drunk on beer.
And the beers that you're talking about, these aren't the 5, 6, 7% beers that we see today. These were sort of lighter, almost watered-down fare, right?
Well, the beers that were served in the 19th century were somewhere in the range of like 5 to 6%. So that's a pretty moderate range. It's not really what you would call watered down or a light beer, but at the same time, it's not, you know, like the 7% sort of IPAs or imperial stouts. Those are often up 7 to 10% that you would see today.
We are.
So it's a judgment call. It probably was never true that the majority of beer served in America was not intoxicating, but still it was less intoxicating than whiskey or other spirits. So the temperance movement in the mid-19th century focused on spirits, and it had smashing successes. Consumption of whiskey and other spirits went down dramatically, but then you had the big wave of German immigration and the so-called lager beer craze. And the temperance movement had, you know, its work cut out for them.
We are talking right now with Ranjit Dugay. He is a professor of economics at the State University of New York. We are talking about where Americans' taste for so-called blander beers came from. And Ranjit, we had Prohibition in the early 20th century, which you say laid the groundwork for a nation of bland beer drinkers. How did that work?
Yeah, we were kind of on the way there already because the temperance movement really got going right about, well, the prohibition movement, rather. The original temperance movement was a voluntary movement, and it was very successful, as I said, in getting people to take pledges to stop drinking, and especially to stop drinking whiskey. There was an issue. Not everybody agreed whether beer and ale fell into that category. A lot of people in the temperance movement were very uncompromising, and it became more and more so. So then you finally got nationwide prohibition, you know, by 1920, and you had state-level prohibitions before that. The brewers naturally were kind of on the defensive as far as this went. They didn't want to ally themselves with whiskey and other spirits because that's where the temperance movement had its greatest success. So they tried to distance themselves from that and say that they were a temperance beverage. Best way to prove that you're a temperance beverage is for your beverage to look very pale and mild and non-threatening. We didn't have a lot of scientific data on like alcohol by volume and stuff like that by that back then. If it looked very clear and it tasted very bland, then it seemed like it wouldn't be that intoxicating.
Sure. And then Prohibition ends, and then brewers at this point are sort of free to do what they want. But we really didn't see great experimentation in the beer industry until maybe the last 20 years. Is there an easy explanation for what accounts of the 50 to 60 years or so of bland beers dominating the markets?
Yeah, I think so. I think the temperance movement was just, although it was a worldwide movement, is exceptionally strong in this country. Just about everyone had some kind of prohibition around the time of World War One or just after. Ours lasted the longest. 13 years is a very long prohibition. During that time, prohibition, of course, was not completely successful. Things like wine and spirits tended to flourish, especially spirits were very easily concealed. Beer was not. Wine could be made relatively easily at home with wine grapes, which became a big industry all around the country. Beer was a little harder to do. So beer consumption fell off dramatically during Prohibition. And people who flouted Prohibition and drank were generally drinking wine or spirits. So you didn't have a lot of beer consumption during Prohibition, certainly not a lot of selection. The selection had gone down quite a bit in the past, in the 20 or so years before Prohibition, as lager and especially the American Pilsner sort of lager, something like Pabst Blue Ribbon or Budweiser, where it's a small amount of malt and hops adjuncted with corn or rice or some other cereal grain.
And
but after Prohibition, people just weren't really used to much of a variety. There was the dark lagers and so forth that still existed before Prohibition were in very little demand after Prohibition.
And very briefly here, Ranjit, as we wrap up, we're leaving a lot of history on the table, but are bland beers here to stay?
Oh, absolutely. And I wouldn't want them to go away. This variety is the spice of life, we economists always say. And it's good for people to have a choice. 30 years ago, you really did not have a choice. It was bland beer or nothing. It was bland domestic beer or bland imported beer. But you didn't have the type of choice we have right now.
Well, that's a good place to leave it. Ranjit, thank you for joining us today.
Okay, thank you very much. Enjoyed myself.
Ranjit Dugay is a professor of economics at the University of New York at Oswego. He joined us to talk about how, even amid the craft beer boom, bland beer is here to stay.